Accession number 28650, Mr. Gordon Mellor, Reel 11. Now, after this second crash, I noticed that the next person to take up is Squadron Leader Bamford the next day. Was that partially just to give you confidence or something?
I think so. He also wanted to see how we reacted and how we sort of coped with the job.
Do you have any problems? Any of you?
No. We all stuck together and it seemed to be just one of those things.
Now, this squadron leader Bamford, do you remember anything about him? Was he a key...
Oh, he was a regular Air Force officer. I would have jumped to sort of guess his age. He could have been in his late 30s, perhaps early 40s. He was an experienced man, there's no doubt about that. He had got a good lot of service in. We then, as far as I can remember, just carried on with our exercises until we came to virtually the end of the course. Oh, there was a change. We lost our radio operator. There was a chap on the course who was... Ted Willey. We lost him. There was a crew who were a bit more advanced than us, a bit further along the line, and their radio operator was taken ill, sick, or something of that nature. So they transferred Ted Willey to us. From us.
Yeah, because they were further ahead.
Yes.
So who did you get instead? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. He progressed up to us. I should have a look on the...
It'll come back to you, yeah. I suspect.
Yes, it'll come back.
Now, did you do a test operation while you were...
Yes, this was... more or less at the end of the training there, and there were 6 aircraft who were scheduled to go on this single flight, and they're all largely from our group, or perhaps one of the other groups which was running parallel with us. We had a load of nickels put on board our particular aircraft.
What,
which were
nickels?
The nickels? Yeah, they were the pamphlets that were dropped in many of the early raids.
So this is a propaganda pamphlet.
Oh yeah, so right they were, this was our first introduction to them as we were flying over enemy territory, and I think it was Lille that we were directed to fly to. Having sort of got to a point called Fern, I think it was on the Belgian coast. We then flew down to Lille, and we circled round there, shoveling this hundredweight of pamphlets out, or however much there was. They had to go down the flare chute, and they were in packets of probably 3 inches thick or more, held together with an elastic band, and you just heave them down. So the bed... was a collapsible sort of arrangement in the fuselage of the Wellington, was loaded up with these things in packets, and myself and another fellow had the pleasure of dropping them out. We weren't right over Lille. We had to allow for the fact that the wind was going to carry them a distance, and I suppose we perhaps up around about 10,000 feet. I don't remember wearing an oxygen mask while we were doing it. I know we got out of breath quite a bit, but there was quite a load of these things to chuck out, and it took quite some minutes and fair amount of circles by the pilot in over the same part of the country to get rid of them. We then sort of set off in a westerly direction, and we had another turning point given to us.
Seems a bit Charleroi.
We then had to make our way to the French coast. while we were dropping the nickels out, then of course we took a flash photograph with the hope that they would be able to identify the spot that we actually pushed them out. Subsequently, it was a decent photograph, but it didn't show enough detail for it to be identified for sure. It's just a matter of a road crossing and an offshoot off a lane and what have you. So we went over a night fighter, well, certainly an aerodrome in northern France, and we wondered whether we'd got one bomb on board. I'm not sure whether we dropped it there or not. Anyhow, we did a circuit over them, and there was a plane landing. We could see its lights, and then all of a sudden, the whole lot went out. They had heard us, realised where we were up above there, and they decided to just hide themselves. So then we went up to the French coast and across the Channel, and we very heartily saw Seaside Town on our coast, which we recognised, and back up to Lichfield. So it was largely an uneventful trip.
So you weren't attacked at all? Any anti-aircraft fire you were aware of?
Not that I'm aware of any. No, we sort of crept in. I imagine possibly there was a bigger raid on in Germany somewhere, and perhaps the reserves were pulled out towards Belgium and that direction. But we didn't have any problem, although we saw aircraft were flying away. And they might have been training aircraft. We couldn't tell from that height.
Now, but you did suffer casualties, not in your group, but I mean, no, of the six planes.
Well, that was a rather strange point. I don't know that anybody was lost, but they certainly, we were the only plane that got back that night. And we were first back, as such. And there was, nav leader was Rosevier. Flight Lieutenant Rosevier, there was flight commanders are there. Anyhow, there was quite a little collection of the permanent staff gathered in the control tower, and after we landed, we were deposited there to go up, and they were highly delighted that we were back, and said, "You're the first, jolly good show." So we thought, right, so we buzzed off to have some food and then get to bed. It wasn't until late morning that I was going down to wash and shave and what have you. I saw one of our course and he said, "You were jolly lucky, you're the only one to get back." So I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, nobody else got back last night except you." I said, "Well, where are they?" He said, "I don't know." Anyhow, it turned out that I think most of them had landed elsewhere and hadn't completed the journey on that in that one flight.
Now, what happened after this operation? Was there anything else at Lichfield, or was that the end?
No, that virtually was the closing scene of our stay at Lichfield. They put us onto leave, and the Australians have got ideas about where they wanted to go to London. I think they were going to whoop it up a bit, but so I came home here to Wembley, and I saw the close family, and I went down, saw my grandmother and what have you, and I seem to remember, yes, there was one of my cousins, Peter. He was on leave. He was in the Navy. He had been he had gone into the Navy just before Dunkirk, about a fortnight beforehand, and he found himself at Dunkirk before he could take a second breath. But he was there, and we went into the local pub, the Cupid, Cupid Green, and had a jar, and he went back to the family for to come back home. And one of my aunts said, You haven't been over Germany yet, or you haven't been over to France or something like that back. And I said, oh yes, we were over there the other night. And she could hardly believe it, the fact, you know, it was still virtually, I suppose one was training, and yet you'd done a trip over. But we hadn't been to Germany with me, to mainly into France. So we then caught a train. We had to be there at some hour the next day.
Well,
I caught an overnight train from King's Cross, I think I went to. And we arrived sometime in the morning.
And where were you joining? This was to join your squadron, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes.
And that was?
That was 103 Squadron. At Elsham Wold.
And that's in Lincolnshire?
North Lincolnshire, yes.
Cool. So, now, this was your first active service posting. What were your first impressions when you got to Elsham Wold? Of the setup of the squadron? This is May 1942.
Yes. We got a lift up from we got a lift up from the station. The MT sent a lorry down. We got a lift up. I'm not sure. Yes, I think we were the only crew that went there on that particular day, and we proceeded uphill. The station was down in the bottom of the valley near. Virtually in the village of Barnetby, and we went off through the main gate and across the bottom of one runway around a wood, and were dumped at the sergeant's mess. So we had to get some instructions then as to where we were to be billeted and what the form was, and we were sent off down a short lane to some Nissen huts. These were big Nissen huts, and they were all numbered so that we got to the right one. And so that there was our crew in this one, and another crew. Some of the fellows we'd known at Lichfield. So it wasn't as if we were going cold into a new environment. We knew people already, and as Lichfield supplied a lot of the crews to 103 Squadron, then there were familiar faces around in the squadron itself. And the following day, then we were in the squadron hut, and CO asked to see us, so we left right into the wing commander's hut, or into his office.
Is this group captain Hugh Constantine?
No, it
wasn't.
Ah,
right, sorry.
No, this was wing commander Duboulay, and we were a bit taken aback, because in actual fact Duboulay had been the CO of 27 OTU when we first arrived, and it wasn't long before we were posted to Elsham that he was posted there as squadron commander. So he said, where were you training last? So he said, Lichfield, 27 OTU. He said, oh, well, you were properly trained then. And we had a brief talk with him, and allocated to one of the flights. I was sent to, crew was sent to B flight, and squadron leader begins with S. Oh, come to it in a minute. Too. But there we then sort of came into the crew. We had a flight, and within a short time we were on ops, and our first trip was the first 1,000 raid to Cologne.
Now, anything else before? I mean, did you have any other final training or revisional training before?
No, you were deemed to be trained up And as I say, we had a cross country flight to get us used to the aircraft. They were the same. They said Wellington 1C, so there was nothing new about that, except that they seemed to have more power than the ones at the OTU. And we were allocated to an experienced pilot, a chap called Stan Land, sergeant.
Now, what was he like?
Well, he
was he actually joining your crew?
No, we were joining him. And he was put in charge of us as the captain of the crew. He'd done something like 22-odd trips. He knew the score. He was an excellent pilot.
What was he like as a person?
Experienced, if you can put it like that. Yes, so he sort of he kept his position as such. He was all right. We called him skipper or something.
Was he a nice chap?
Oh yes, he was quite a pleasant chap, but he was the leader of the gang, so to speak, and of course he had his own friends in the mess, and we then we got to know him better as we went along. We were a bit in awe of him, of course, because he was sort of got some decent experience behind him.
Now, what we want to do is look at a typical raid. Now, your first raid on the 30th of May 1942 was also the first 1,000 bomber raid, which was Cologne.
Yes.
And if we could treat this, you say that you were on the next two or three as well.
Yes.
And they're all pretty much the same. If we look at this as a typical raid, when would you first know that you got? How were you told you were going on a raid?
I suppose as navigators, we heard immediately after lunch. The word would go round that would be a navigator's briefing at 2:30, 3 o'clock, whatever. Station nav officer called. There was an indication because, of course, all flight checks were done before lunch. Everybody in the RAF who was flying and testing aircraft, they did it all at the same time in the morning.
Now, would you go up on an air test?
Not normally.
So who would do
that? The pilot would go up. The second pilot, if there was one, would probably go, and probably the radio operator or somebody like that. But it wasn't usual for the navigator to go. And there may have been one of the ground crew were involved, but I don't ever recall going up on the flight test.
Now, so you have the air test. Now, what would this? This is a special navigator's briefing. This is separate from the briefing
Yes.
of everyone.
Yes.
Now, what would happen at a navigator's briefing? Well, we haven't heard much about these, so if you could.
No, well, this is the first time it sort of really happened. You would attend with your bag of tricks, instruments, and what have you, and charts, and.
Now, what would be in your bag of tricks? What instruments would you take?
Oh, well, Douglas protractor, your calculators, pens, pencils. Just depend what was... sometimes they had an instrument like the they use in drawing offices, sort of pantograph arrangement. And you could sort of there was a compass marked on the perspex of the flat plane, and that could be used actually for drawing in courses and what have you. I usually used the Douglas protractor for doing that. And you would have a bench each, or a desk or a table, whichever was available, and you'd be issued with a Mercator projection. Chart for doing all your plotting on, and the nav officer had the route that you were to take, and all the turning points of the route from a base right through to the target, and then back to base again. And possibly you wouldn't repeat your outward journey in reverse. You would come back a different way. And here we'd have that up, marked up on a wall chart, which was usually covered with a curtain, and a bit of coloured string showing us exactly whereabouts we should be looking for the turning points. These would be quite specific, latitude and longitude, and you'd plot those on first. You'd then give you also meteorological information.
What type of information would you get?
Oh, well, yes, general weather information, in particular the winds at various levels up to your operating height, which was generally about 15,000 feet, so that you'd get a varying winds.
And how accurate would that be in your experience?
It was a good indication. It was a good indication. Sometimes it developed over the afternoon and the length of your flight, so that when you got perhaps over Germany, then the conditions were somewhat different to what they had anticipated. I mean, there was a fair number of hours could have passed. With that information, we then set to calculate the courses we'd have to steer, assuming that these winds were correct. And so that on the chart you would have this all marked out in the top part of the chart to guide you as you went through the operation. That was also there of use in case the navigator got knocked out with anti-aircraft fire or something like that. If the aircraft was hit and somebody else had to get them back, there was at least a series of courses on the first part of the log that anybody could read, give them to the pilot, and he could fly those courses, and then you'd hit the British coast somewhere. So that that was just an emergency situation, but we would work out the courses and we'd sort of chatter about it and see whether we were all coming up with somewhat similar in our calculations and results. We'd mark the chart up with the track we were supposed to follow, and then we also had the time, worked out the time it was, how many minutes from one turning point to the other. Assuming those winds were prevailing exactly as being forecast, so that you prepared your log for the whole of the trip, assuming that those winds prevailed, as I said, with times, air speeds, ground speeds, and we couldn't really put down times by the clock that we expect to be there because we didn't know exactly when you're going to take off. So, but you'd got the intervals, so you could just add them on as you went along. And we did have also the time on the target, so that we had something in mind to work back from. And that was the navigator's briefing. When everybody was satisfied and got all the information about what we see, was it moonlight or was it dark? You would see such and such a lake or such and such a river showing up in the moonlight. You would pick up as much as you could off of the topographical map to ask the front gunner and the rear gunner to look out for, to feed information to you, because you didn't have a lot of time for waiting for something to show itself. What they would do, they would say, we're coming up to a river, I'll tell you when we get there, and within a couple of minutes or so we're there now. And while you were actually on the trip, then that was the most useful information that they were able to give you.
So that's the navigational briefing, and
right,
that took place first.
Yes.
Now what's the next thing?
Well, depending on the timing of takeoff. Sometimes we had a full briefing, sometimes we had a meal, and then we went to the full briefing. It depended on the time and of takeoff, in actual fact. If the time was a bit short, then you'd come out of the briefing, your charts and all your stuff would be in your bag, and of course, first thing everybody wanted to know was, where are we going? And one was a bit careful about that. I usually used to tell the pilot, the captain, and then if he wanted to tell the rest of the crew, then he could.
Were you conscious of the importance of secrecy?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I never tried to get out of at Elsham when there was a raid on. Because usually the whole squadron was involved, as many aircraft as possible, so that we didn't have to go up to near the guard room to see whether you would be stopped. But at other places, then certainly, if you weren't included on the raid, then and the target had been announced, you couldn't get out. I'd imagine that also prevailed in at Elsham guard room as well.
Now, what about the main? Is the next thing then the main briefing?
Yes,
now,
is the main
about
briefing. This was where everybody who was operating. Well, the whole crew and every crew, and we all sort of bundled into this large hall, so to speak. There was rows and rows of chairs there, and you used to sit as a crew normally. It was not a written rule, but it usually happened. I would usually sit where the pilots were, and we'd have a curtained off area on the wall in the front. And the CO would be there, the group captain would be there, the gunnery leader, navigation leader, and the bombing leader, which were usually of flight lieutenant ranks, and the squadron CO would be there. And the CO would largely take control, and the group captain would sit in, so to speak. And first of all, they'd whip the curtains aside, and there would be the big war map of the whole of Europe and Scandinavia and what have you. And the target would be pinned up with a string leading to it and the route back, which we already knew as far as the navigators were concerned. But there were some sharp hisses of the breath. And look at that sort of to the people who didn't know, and it just depended if you were going to perhaps Emden or something like that, where most of your trip was over the sea, and so the back was didn't raise much of a hiss, but if you're going into the middle of the Ruhr or something like that, then not that place again, so to speak.
Now, what was the reaction like when to Cologne? And were you told it was 1,000 bombers?
Oh, yes, right? Yes. This having sort of got this view of the map, then everybody knew it was Cologne. But they didn't know until, I can't tell you whether it was the group captain or the wing commander who gave the point, that one of them then made the point, this is a special raid, everybody is taking part. Well, we knew that because we'd had air crew come in from the OTUs with their aircraft. We were stacked with aircraft around the aerodrome. And so there was something special. And he said, we are now putting up 1,000 aircraft in one raid in an hour and a half, 90 minutes. And there was a great big cheer. Yes, we were quietened down, and then we got down to the business of the briefing and the various specialists who went through their particular spiel,